From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am in such despair that so many young women do not identify themselves as feminists. I think it's tragic, you know? We have one word in the English language that means that women are people, too, and we've bought the conservative propaganda, the sort of media marginalization of that word. They've made it taboo, they've made it dirty, they've made it unsexy, they've made it boring and archaic, and young women bought it.
Radical musician Ani DeFranco today in the studio for an hour as we continue our series on art and revolution. All that and more on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States lost its seat at the United Nations Human Rights Commission for the first time since the panel's founding in 1947. The secret balloting took place at the UN Economic and Social Council in New York, which is the parent body of the 53-nation Geneva-based Human Rights Commission. The Human Rights Commission assigns investigators to probe abuses around the world. Both friends and enemies of the United States voted France, Austria, and Sweden into the three seats reserved for Western nations. Reed Brody joins us now from France, the advocacy director for Human Rights Watch. Can you talk about the significance of this move, the exclusion of the United States from the UN Human Rights Commission?
Well, really what happened here is that countries got fed up with the United States. Traditional enemies of the United States voted, like China and Cuba, obviously resent the United States for its campaigns against them. But really what happened here is that Western countries voted against the United States, probably because of the U.S.'s go-alone position on issues like the International Criminal Court, its lone vote against a resolution to make AIDS drugs available to all in need, its opposition to the Landmines Treaty, as well as probably policies like going away from the Kyoto Accord, issues like the death penalty in the United States. A lot of countries have seen the U.S. acting very politically when it comes to human rights, voting one way on countries like China and Cuba, but then voting alone in defense of Israel.
What do you think will happen now?
Well, the commission is going to go on. The world will go on. The countries that were elected, France, Austria, and Sweden, are countries that deserve to be there. The United States will probably portray this as the revenge of the bad guys. And to some extent, you have to give the U.S. credit for taking on issues like China that other countries do not. But what's important to show here is that this was a combined vote. Countries that traditionally oppose the U.S., but also Western countries that are fed up with the U.S.'s very isolated stand on a lot of human rights issues.
Reed Brody, I want to thank you for being with us, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch. And the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees blasted as a mockery the light sentences imposed by an Indonesian court today on six men convicted of murdering three UN workers in West Timor last year. It was one of the bloodiest attacks ever on UN civilian personnel. One of those three workers was from Puerto Rico. And a Manhattan judge has again blocked efforts by private citizens to post bail for a man in jail for more than 15 months. Calvin Baker, who's African-American, was arrested in December of 1999 when a policeman claimed he witnessed from a football field away the defendant sell a $10 bag of heroin. A juror, Paula Thompson, first hung the jury, then, in what may be the first case of its kind, posted $2,500 bail for Baker. But after Baker had been free for 10 days, the judge raised the bail to $10,000. Now the judge has blocked attempts to post bail again. Randy Credico was attempting to post that bail. He's with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Randy Credico joins us on the line. Can you tell us about this action yesterday?
Well, I went in there with a fellow from Wall Street, from Bear Stearns, and with $10,000 on Monday. He put up $6,500. I put up $3,500. We got in yesterday. The district attorney or assistant DA grilled me for about 20 minutes, asked me all sorts of impertinent questions about my relationship here with organizations that are against the current war on drugs. And afterwards, they denied me posting the bail on something called public policy. So I wasn't allowed to bail the young man out. So today, the attorney, Mr. Levinson, will be appealing that case.
Randy Credico, thanks for being with us. William Moses, Counselor Fund for Racial Justice. And you are listening to Democracy Now!
During the plague of Reagan and Bush, watching capitalism gun down democracy, it had this funny effect on me, I guess. I am cancer, I am HIV, and I'm down at the Blue Jesus Blue Cross Hospital, just looking up from my pillow, feeling blessed. And the mighty multinationals have monopolized the oxygen, so it's as easy as breathing for us all to participate. Yes, they're buying and selling off shares of air, and you know it's all around you, but it's hard to point and say there. So you just sit on your hands and quietly contemplate your next bold move, the next thing you're gonna need to prove to yourself. And what a waste of thumbs that are opposable to make machines that are disposable and sell them to seagulls flying in circles around one big right wing. Yes, the left wing was broken long ago by the slingshot of COINTELPRO, and now it's so hard to have faith in anything. Especially your next bold move, the next thing you're gonna need to prove to yourself. Each trickle back to its source, and then scream up the faucet till your face is hoarse, cause you're surrounded by a world's worth of things you just can't excuse. You've got the hard cough of a chain smoker, and you're at the Arctic Circle playing strip poker, and it's getting colder and colder every time you lose. So go ahead, make your next bold move. Tell us, what's the next thing you're gonna need to prove to yourself.
Ani DeFranco singing Your Next Bold Move here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. She's a songwriter, guitarist, and vocalist. At 30, she's released 14 solo albums and produced many others. Refusing to bow to the power of record companies from the very beginning, she founded her own record label at age 19. Over the years, her music has woven together styles ranging from folk to funk, soul to jazz to R&B. She sings of the personal and political, of love, sexuality, and loneliness, of sexual abuse and police brutality, and about the perversion of democracy in America. She's furious, she's funny, she's funky, and she's passionate, even if that doesn't begin with an F. She's Ani DeFranco. And that's Mr. DeFranco to you. And she's become, perhaps against her will, a role model for hundreds of thousands of young women in America and around the world. Ani DeFranco was born in the blue-collar city of Buffalo, New York. She was exposed to music at an early age by traveling folk singers who spent evenings at her family's home when performing in town. She picked up a guitar at age 9 and a few years later began writing her own songs and playing in local coffee houses. She moved to New York when she was 19. Within a year, she recorded a cassette titled simply Ani DeFranco and put it out on her own label. By 1993, major labels were approaching her regularly, and Ani regularly rejected their offers. The president and CEO of Mercury Records, Danny Goldberg, who's credited with helping to transform Nirvana from a local Seattle band to the leading edge of a new wave of music, said of DeFranco, "She's one of the most brilliant and compelling artists out now, a genius." Righteous Babe Records never returned his call. In April, Ani DeFranco released a double CD called Reveling Reckoning, and that's what that first song was from. And today we continue with our series on art and revolution with Ani DeFranco in our studio for the hour. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
Now!
Thank you. What an intro. I don't know what to say now.
Well, can you tell us about that song?
I guess I've been doing a little bit more looking back than I have in the past in my songwriting. I was just sort of pondering my formative years in the 80s. I've never really known politics or politicians that weren't just lying, greedy, capitalist scumbags. I mean, I think... Carter might have been president when I was born, but I don't remember him so much, the last nice guy around. So I've sort of structured my whole life in a kind of anti-corporate way, and I think it had a lot to do with the world that I grew up in, the culture that I was exposed to from the beginning of my political consciousness.
What was the beginning of your political consciousness?
Well, you know, I don't know that there was a moment of you know, a shaft of light that pierced the darkness or a moment of revelation. I think it was a bunch of years of learning and certainly moving to New York. And I went to the New School for Social Research for a couple of years and just sort of wafted about those buildings, taking, classes on Malcolm X and, you know, introductory feminism. And I had a lot of really enlightening conversations. And
even before that, I mean, you started so early. You got a guitar at the age of 9.
Mm-hmm.
And you were very independent in your family. Can you talk about your parents?
Yeah, my parents were, lucky for me, they were liberal people, open-minded people, somewhat older, though. My father is 80 now, and I'm 30. So there was a big generation gap going on there. But they certainly taught me to appreciate and embrace everyone, you know, and not be selective that way. So, but my family sort of dissolved pretty early on, and I was, I think, probably the biggest factor in my independence and my, I don't know, my personality was the fact that I was on my own, you know, when I was 15. And so my parents armed me with, you know, enough self-respect and common sense to get by, and so I did.
So how did you end up linking up with the whole folk scene in Buffalo?
Well, that started back when my parents were still together. I was a 9-year-old kid, and I befriended a local folk singer, barfly, sort of philosophy-reading, alcoholic, real personality in Buffalo. His name is Michael Meldrum, and he's a wonderful, wonderful human being, and he sort of was my first mentor. He took me around to his gigs in bars and, you know, taught me folk songs, and we just sat around singing a lot. So,
and meeting a lot of folk singers coming through.
Yeah, yeah. He was also promoting shows in Buffalo. He would bring people in from New York. He had what he called the Greenwich Village Song Project, and he would bring songwriters in. And so, you know, my early experience of music were all, you know, as a social act, you know, not as a commodity. It was not something I bought or coveted on the TV. It was something I did and something everybody around me was doing. So I think that had a big impression.
So you came to New York. You gave out some cassettes on demand of your music. And, like, it seems like within minutes you had your own record company. How did that happen?
Well, you know, there wasn't... The record company was just three words that I wrote on my tapes at the time. There wasn't, you know, it would be misleading to think that Righteous Babe Records sprung, you know, full-grown from my brow at age 19. It was really just... It was almost like my little joke with myself, you know, oh, I don't need a record company, I'll just write Righteous Babe Records on my little cassette and sell it at my gigs. But in the beginning, it was just an idea, I mean, for many years. You know, now we got an office and a coffee machine and some people who, I don't know what they do over there, but...
How did you come up with the title Righteous Babe?
You know, I don't remember specifically. It just, I mean, I think it was that just kind of inherent to the time. I remember me and my friend Susie used to call each other babe all the time, you know, just as a joke, because that's what men would call us on the street, and we always thought it was funny, you know, we'd hey babe each other. So I think it kind of came from that.
Can you talk about Not a Pretty Girl?
Yeah. That goes back a few years. It was a song I wrote about... just the idea of feminine beauty, and it seems to me so connected with passivity and, you know, I mean, the image of the damsel, the gorgeous, you know, damsel in distress with her hands tied behind her back, you know, seemed to be the height of, you know, feminine allure. And I noticed that in my own little life with my shaved head and my big black boots, and I wasn't getting hey babed as much as I did when I had hair and, you know, dressed more femininely, and so I just thought a lot about the fact that I was not pretty anymore in the eyes of, you know, the culture around me, and I started to think about pretty and how it is defined by the culture. Not a pretty girl, that's not what I do. I ain't no damsel in distress, and I don't need to be rescued, so put me down, punk. Wouldn't you prefer a maiden fair? Isn't there a kitten stuck up a tree somewhere? I'm not an angry girl, but it seems like I've got everyone fooled. Every time I say something they find hard to hear, they chalk it up to my anger, never to their own fear. Imagine your girl just trying to finally come clean. clean, knowing full well they prefer you were dirty, and smiling, and I am sorry. But I am not made in fear, and I am not a kitten stuck up a tree somewhere. Generally, my generation wouldn't be caught dead working for the man. And generally, I agree with them. Trouble is, you gotta have yourself an alternate plan. And I have earned my disillusionment. I have been working all my life, and I am a patriot. I have been fighting the good fight. And what if there are no damsels in distress? What if I knew that and I called your bluff? Don't you think every kitten figures out how to get down? Whether or not you were for sure. Pretty girl.
Ani DiFranco here on Democracy Now. Back with her in a minute. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and our guest for this hour in our continuing series on art and revolution is Ani DiFranco. And it's a great privilege to have you here, by the way.
I'm thrilled to be here. You know, I've heard about your show for so long, but I've never heard it. So now I get to hear it in person,
I think most important
exciting.
Is that people get to hear you and all over the country. And, of course, they're listening to you. Probably a lot of people right now heard your first cassette and have heard your CDs. And now, again, the latest one is a double CD set, and it just came out last month. It's called Reckoning Reveling.
Yeah.
How do you deal with your audience?
And
I know it's an issue you sing about. It's an issue that you talk about and you have to deal with every minute of your life.
Well, you know, my relationship with my audience, it's very much like family. You know, you can't stand them. You love them. You need them. There is very much a family vibe. I mean, I'm not really, I don't have myself any radio hits so the audience that I do have didn't really come along because of any big, hubbub or any hype. They've sort of grown with me for so many years. So there's a real love and a real mutual respect there. But sometimes, at my shows, the first few, 10 rows can be kind of fervent, kind of excitable. And so, I'm always walking that line between really appreciating them and the depth that they listen
and also just struggling with that kind of, you know, I don't really, I don't think it's conducive to art or communication to have that kind of, you know, rock star worship, you know, fervor going down. So I'm always trying to counteract that on stage and just try and reinforce my humanity. And I think it's, I think that relationship between performer and audience, myself and my listeners, is a much more dynamic one if we all realize that we're very much the same, that we are connected, that we are not separate. Just because I'm on a platform and I got a microphone, you know, I hate for that to for me to become a symbol, you know, instead of a person.
I mean, your message is very much, especially to young women, to be yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting
yeah.
that you get sort of trapped in what their image is of you.
Yeah.
You sing about that in My Plastic Castle.
Mm, yeah, Little Would Plastic
Castle. Would you mind
castle.
Singing a little?
Well, you
Could
know,
you?
That's on a different kind of guitar. It's on a, I wrote it on a tenor guitar.
We'll play it on your CD.
Okay. Sorry.
Little Plastic Castle by Ani DiFranco.
In a coffee shop in a city, which is every coffee shop in every city, on a day which is every day, I picked up a magazine which is every magazine. I read a story and then I forgot it right away. And they say goldfish have no memory. I guess their lives are much like mine. And the little plastic castle is a surprise every time. And it's hard to say if they're happy, but they don't seem much to mine. From the shape of your shaved head, I recognized your silhouette as you walked out of the sun and sat down. And the sight of your sleepy smile eclipsed all the other people as they paused to sneer at the two girls. Or maybe there's some kind of local competition here to see who can be the rudest. And people talk about my image like I come in two dimensions, like lipstick is a sign of my declining mind. Like what I happen to be wearing the day that someone takes a picture is my new statement for all of womankind. And I wish they could see us now in leather bras, shorts, like some ridiculous new team uniform for some ridiculous new sport. Quick, someone call the girl police and file a report.
Little Plastic Castle. On the issue of Righteous Babe Records, we were talking to Michael Franti earlier in the week. Mm-hmm. Also, he puts out his CDs independently now.
Mm-hmm.
How you are able to maintain your art, do your music, and run a business? I mean, you've been pretty defiant about this independent label.
A whole lot of help. I mean, you know, honestly, I don't run the business. There's a guy sitting behind you, Scott, that does, and he and the other people at Righteous Bay Records are really, you know, they're making it up as they go along. And, you know, I'm usually out touring and you know, writing songs. And my involvement with Righteous Babe Records is very much on the, you know, the theoretical level and the decision-making level. But to be able to do, you know, what a little company like Righteous Babe Records has.
And did you ever think of just giving it all up and going to a major label? I mean, they've certainly all approached you.
Yeah. Well, you know, it used to be really tempting. You know, for a lot of years I was struggling and, you know, grazing in the bulk food section of the supermarket. And I would see a lot of young performers who would be opening for me, you know, 1 week, and then 6 months later they'd be all over the MTV and they'd have a hit single and they'd be on the covers of all the magazines and I'd still be in that same little club. And this would go on year after year, and it was hard not to be jealous. It was hard to be happy where I was sometimes, you know, to really, but I've always been fulfilled by writing music, by giving music to people, even in small bars and coffee houses, and that helped me be patient. And after about 10 years, it's not even tempting anymore, you know, because I put in that time and have grown an audience organically. And now I'm very comfortable, you know, financially, and I don't worry if anybody's going to show up to a club when I get to town. You know, it's really worked out quite well.
You have to worry if there's going to be a riot.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, you know, the tough years are behind me. Now it's not tempting at all.
And how has fame changed your writing and your music and your view of the world? I mean, for one thing, you've lost your anonymity to sit in a little place and just observe people.
Well, you know, I think it's being a public person, it kind of ups the ante a little bit in terms of really, really trying to have grace in your everyday life and trying to appreciate people and listen to people even though you're exhausted and even though you might want them to go away. I do know some very famous people who bring a lot of love and a lot of grace to their interactions with the public, and I find that inspirational. You know, I have friends like Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon, and you should see them on the street. You know, they're very gracious. And so, I mean, there's a lot worse problems to have in life than having people, you know, coming up and appreciating you randomly and vehemently when you're, you know, when you want to be anonymous. So I feel grateful.
Can you talk about Blood in the Boardroom?
Oh, my goodness. Now we're really going back. Wow. Well, I could try. As much as I remember it, I haven't played that song in a while.
Or start off by telling us what you think feminism means.
I think feminism means us, too. You know, civil rights, human rights, equal rights, you know, that includes babes, right? That's all it means to me. It means that women are human beings and they should have the right of self-determination just as any human being. And I am in such despair that so many young women do not identify themselves as feminists. I think it's tragic. You know, we have one word in the English language that means that women are people too, and we've bought the conservative propaganda, the sort of media marginalization of that word. They've made it taboo. They've made it dirty. They've made it unsexy. They've made it boring and archaic. And young women bought it. It seems in very large numbers. And I think that at this point in our cultural history, we should all be using that word. You know, men, women, we're all feminists, right? Unless we're blatant misogynists. And I fear that the death of a word is very much connected with the death of a concept. You know, the way that our human brains work, you know, our ideas come to us in the form of words, and language is the vehicle that we think with. So I really hope that that word will have a renaissance, and that young women will realize the importance of honoring their foremothers who changed the world for them so that they could be free.
When did you write Blood in the Boardroom?
Gosh, I don't know. I was probably 19 or so. Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the words specifically, but I... it's, you know, the basic imagery is about being in a boardroom, in a business, some sort of corporate context. You know, I used to have lunches with, I used to get as many free lunches as I could out of record company people. And, of course, the woman in the song leaves a little blood stain on her, you know, cream-colored chair. And it's just that kind of, you know, that metaphor of you know, the power of even a young woman, you know, up against, you know, a huge corporation, you know, I has the power to, say, create life, which compared to amassing money, I think there's no contest there.
I want to play just a little bit of it.
Okay.
Your CD, so I'm not going to make you retune that beautiful guitar. You're not going to cringe, are you?
Oh, maybe a little.
Annie DeFranco singing Blood in the Boardroom from her CD Pedal Dive. We'll continue with her in our last segment here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we are continuing our Art and Revolution series with radical activist, singer, and songwriter Annie DeFranco.
Can you talk about your mother?
My mom. Well, she's, you know, people, whenever I, when I lived with her for a few years between when I was 11 and 15, and people used to think, confuse us on the phone, you know, we're very, very much alike. I take after her in my sort of chipper, you know, cheerful, you know. She's a very energetic person, a really creative person. She was an architect. Back in the day, she was the first woman in her class at MIT, and she, you know, she's always the first woman in any firm she worked in, and very independent person. So I think I got my chops from her.
You talk about sing about sexuality, about sexual abuse, like in Hide and Seek, singing songs overall about abuse. Why choose that as a theme in your songs? Are you speaking from your own experience?
Well, yeah, and I, you know, I don't, I wonder, I need to go find myself a consciousness-raising group or something and talk to other women about their childhoods. I mean, my experience being a young girl in the, you know, inner city of Buffalo, New York, the big bad city of Buffalo, I mean, there was just so much, you know, we'd be playing out in the street and cars would pull up and men would, you know, try to lure you into the car, or they'd have their pants down, or they'd, you know, there was just always a kind of, you know, I remember there used to be prank phone calls. I'd pick up the phone and some man would start talking dirty. Or there was just so many of those experiences in my formative years. And I somehow guess that I'm not an exception, that my little girlhood was not unique in that way. So I think that, you know, there are these things that affect the consciousness of women long before they're women, and an anger that can build up that I think is very misunderstood and, you know, by people in general.
You want to choose a selection to sort of illustrate your point?
Gosh. Okay, yes. This is a tune called Letter to a John. I'm not gonna tell you what's wrong. I'm just gonna sit on your lap for $5 a song. I want you to pay me for my beauty. I think it's only right, 'cause I have been paying for it all of my life. I wanna take the money I make. Yeah, I just wanna take the money I make. Yeah, I just wanna take the money I make, and I wanna go away. We barely have time
to react in this world, let alone rehearse. And I don't think that I'm better than you, but I don't think that I'm worse. And women learn to be women, and men learn to be men. And I don't blame it all on you, baby, but I don't want to be your friend. I just want to take the money I make. Yeah, I just want to take the money I make. I just want to turn on the money I make. And I want to go away. I was 11 years old. He was as old as my dad. And he took something from me I didn't even know that I had. So don't tell me about decency. Don't tell me about pride. Just give me something for my trouble, 'cause this time it's not free ride. And I just wanna take the money I make. I just wanna take the money I make. I just wanna take the money I make. I wanna go away. Me why I'm crying. I'm not gonna tell you what's wrong. I'm just gonna sit on your lap, baby, for about $10 a song. And I want you to pay me for my beauty. I think it's only right, 'cause I have been paying for it all of my life. And now I just wanna take it. I just wanna take it. I just wanna take off, and I wanna go away.
Letter to a John, Annie DeFranco. That is what people know you for and expect a lot. Every song you sing leads people to pray. You have another CD out now. Oh. You've got a double CD. It's Reckoning, Reveling. How did you come up with the titles and the mixture of songs on both?
Well, you know, originally I thought I was just making one record, and I was going to call it Reckoning. That was one of the early songs, and it seemed to be a recurring theme in my life. A lot of reckoning I've been doing the last year or so, you know, just trying to come to terms with my responsibility, my commitments, my place in this world. And then there was just a lot of really disparate material that I was working on, and I suddenly couldn't imagine it fitting into, squeezing into one little plastic box. So I sort of thought maybe I was making two records. And then the idea of reveling within that struggle, you know, of finding time to enjoy, you know, and to embrace, even during times of emotional turmoil. So that's where this sort of the flip side, the other record, came from.
You have resisted any kind of classification when it comes to all sorts of issues, but sexuality as well. Mm-hmm. In Imperfectly, the CD, In or Out, their eyes are all asking, are you in, are you out? And I think, oh man, what's this about? Tonight you can't put me on any shelf because I came here alone and I'm going to leave by myself. You might have surprised a lot of people, especially women, identified women who just flocked to your music when you got married.
Yeah.
And it seems that your latest CD is a lot about your relationship.
Yeah, yes indeedy. Oh, the marriage is certainly sort of a focus in my new CDs. I've been hitched for about 3 years now, and it's kicking my booty. It's really, so much more than I expected. It's so much more beautiful and so much more difficult than I ever would have guessed. And it's funny, last night I was just doing a benefit for the Estrella Foundation, and you know, here are all these brilliant beautiful, powerful women, you know, who, you know, many of whom were in middle age and who paved the way for so, you know, who have dedicated their lives to queer rights, to you know, women's rights. And I was telling them from stage that I never had the experience, I never had to have the experience of coming out. I was never in. I was born into a world that they changed for me, and I have so much gratitude over that. But one thing that does make me sad is that people don't ask me. They used to ask me all the time about coming out or what was, or, you know, my experiences of, being in love with other women, or how, you know, what my culture was like, and they don't ask that anymore. It's as though, you know, the love that I dedicate myself to now negates the other loves that I've had in my life, or, you know, because I'm hitched to an XY chromosome creature now, that somehow that means that it was untrue up till now or something, which I, it's not real for me, you know. I mean, I find sexuality, my own and most of the people I know, to be on a continuum, you know. I think these social constructions of black and white and gay and straight, those are only useful as the first step to recognizing diversity. But once you can get beyond the fact that there's not just one kind of person out there, then those you know, lines that are drawn, you begin to recognize how what an oversimplification that is. Because there's also no such thing as black or white or gay or straight. We're all so fluid.
Do you want to sing about that?
Sure. Oh, gosh. Gotta think. What song? How about a poem? When I was 4 years old, they tried to test my IQ. They showed me this picture of three oranges and a pear. They asked me which one is different and does not belong. They taught me different is wrong. But when I was 13 years old, I woke up one morning, thighs covered in blood like a war, like a warning that I live in a breakable, takeable body, an ever-increasingly valuable body, that a woman had come in the night to replace me, deface me. See, my body is borrowed. I got it on loan for the time in between my mom and some maggots. I don't need anyone to hold me. I can hold my own. I got highways for stretch marks. See where I've grown. And I sing sometimes, like my life is at stake, because you're only as loud as the noises you make. I am learning to laugh as hard as I can listen, because silence is violence, and women are poor people. If more people were screaming, then I could relax, but a good brain in diddly if you don't have the facts. We live in a breakable, takeable world, an ever-available, possible world, and we can make music like we can make do. Genius is in a backbeat, backseat to nothing if you're dancing, especially something stupid like IQ. And for every lie I unlearn, I learn something new. And I sing sometimes for the war that I fight, because every tool is a weapon if you hold it right.
Ani DeFranco here on Democracy Now! Talking about divisions, you're one of the few white singers who take on the issue of race, and in your latest double CD in Reckoning, you have a song called Subdivision.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, everybody has a color, you know. we're all color, and I think it's very important for white people to talk about racism. Just because it, well, I was going to say because it doesn't affect us directly, but it affects all of us. And in fact, that song, Subdivision, is about how things as insipid and as racism affect everything right down to the architecture. For instance, in the city that I grew up in Buffalo, New York, there's been so much white flight to the suburbs. You know, it's kind of, Buffalo is sort of a mini Detroit, you know, and all of the money has moved out of the city, and they've just abandoned the city to utter dilapidation. And it affects the very fabric of the city, as there's so many abandoned buildings that are just being torn down rampantly. And it's it's just all racism, and it's a problem that we all need to address.
Could you sing it?
Sure. Tuning. The real musically inclined can cop the open tunings from little tuning episodes. All right, then. White people are so scared of black people. They bulldoze out to the country and put up houses on little loop-de-loop streets. And America got its heart cut right out of its chest. And the Berlin Wall still runs down Main Street, separating east side from west. And nothing is stirring, not even a mouse in the boarded up stores and the broken down houses. So they hang colorful banners off all the street lamps just to prove they got no manners, no mercy and no sense. And I wonder what it will take for my city to rise. First we admit our mistakes, and then we open our eyes. The ghosts of old buildings are haunting parking lots in the city of good neighbors that history forgot. Remember the first time I saw someone lying on the cold street. I thought, I can't just walk past here. This can't just be true. But I learned by example to just keep moving my feet. It's amazing the things that we all learn to do. And so we're led by denial, like lambs to the slaughter, serving empires of style and carbonated sugar water and the old farm roads, a four lane that leads to the mall. And our dreams are all guillotines waiting to fall. And I'm wondering what it will take for my country to rise. First we admit our mistakes, and then we open our eyes. Or nature succumbs to one last dumb decision, and America the beautiful is just one big subdivision. Her at night, I,
Ani DeFranco singing Subdivision from her new double CD, Reveling Reckoning, and will continue on Monday as she will tell us about the open letter she wrote to Ralph Nader asking for Green Party leadership in the face of the massive disenfranchisement of African Americans in Florida. And I'm going to be in Florida on Saturday night. I look forward to meeting WMNF listeners at St. Paul's Church. Call WMNF for more details. We also look forward to playing Ani DeFranco singing Pete Seeger on Monday's Democracy Now!, his song about a housewife who tried to stop a shipment of napalm to Vietnam. We hope Bob Kerry will be listening. And also Monday, following up on our historic broadcast yesterday of a botched execution, we'll speak with two reporters who witnessed the execution of Alpha Otis O'Daniel Stevens in 1984 and how their lives will never be the same. That does it for the program. We hope you'll email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!